Next case on our calendar is 96-524, Disciplinary Counsel versus Mark Allen. Aiko, Mr. Wright.
First of all, may I please report? So, Mr. Stern, I feel it's a real honor to be here today. And I say this because I respect the court and its continuing effort to dispense justice, keeping in mind the high value of enforcing my disciplinary orders. I, of course, have the privilege and the heavy responsibility of representing my client as an advocate for justice, and of course, consideration for both my client and his family's future. I don't mind saying I've had a few sleepless nights in this case. I thought I'd talk about a little bit about how I got here. Shortly after I began my new endeavors, Don Barai brought this potential client's file to my attention and asked me whether we were interested in representing him. Frankly, initially, I was very reluctant to deal with the DR as it's a tough subject. Yet I believe justice on an individual basis is due in these cases as in any other. So I reviewed the file and I gave it in its entirety with particular care on the report of the Disciplinary Commission. I think I probably found in that report the same things you posted. One, we have a young man here with an excellent reputation. There was a specific finding with respect to remorse. This young fellow is the first individual in his family with a college education. He's a close-knit family. His dad, 33 years, is a steelworker. He's done an enormous amount of work for the community, working on the school board. He was even elected Citizen of the Year in the Chamber of Commerce in this Liverpool, relatively small year. I'm sure you've looked at his very excellent references from a number of people in this community. And of course, we have prompt and complete restitution in this case. When I looked this case over, frankly, I was surprised to see this type of problem involve a substantial deportation. I read his remarks to the board, as I'm sure you did, as to how he got himself into this case. While no deportation can be justified or totally excused, even on the basis of the enormous amount of cost of development care for his oldest child, there are other focuses that you all should look at on this man's life. We all recognize, and I repeat, there is no excuse for a defalcation involving the funds from a man's law firm or lawyer. I think it's entirely possible the panel may have misread Mr. Yaco's remarks with respect to circumstances which got into the case. More important, the court will find in presenting its case to the panel, that is to say, this next presentation, it specifically relied on the Crowley case and the Lesser case. That fact is noted on page 19 of the board's opinion. These two cases simply do not apply to this particular situation. Crowley and Buster involved a defalcation from the firm, of course, that client's money. In Crowley, there was a net loss of over $130,000 and no restitution. Crowley was the head of the litigation department of one of the four major firms in Cleveland. At every advantage, elite law school. In our case, the commission very fairly noted Mr. Yaco's excellent reputation and his rise to very modest circumstances.
I wanted to ask you about that because in the brief I got the impression from the comparison between the respondent here and Mr. Crowley that we should expect a lower standard of conduct from attorneys in Appalachia than we should of attorneys in Cleveland or someplace else. Is that the impression that...
Mr. Chief Justice, if I gave that impression, I certainly didn't mean to. I really want to point out how this man brought himself up, in effect, by his bootstraps, which leads to some regard for his character. No, I'm not trying to suggest that because someone rich steals, that is worse than someone who's poor. I will say this. In Crowley's case, I can see no other motivation other than greed. Because here was a man who's making somewhere between $300,000 and $500,000 a year as a crime-like partner in a major law firm, head of the litigation
And I guess the argument is that the respondent here was in a law firm in which he was not compensated enough, or not compensated at least at a level at which he thought he should be compensated, so he just skimmed off some of the fees.
I don't buy that for a minute. I don't think there's any excuse for what he did. I think the facts are the facts, and I make no excuse for them. I know what motivated them, but that's not an excuse.
But that is, that means you said he's used for medical bills, pay medical bills instead of whatever Crowley used his for. Isn't the suggestion that he was struggling, he's in Appalachia, he's in the community, he's doing a lot of work for the community, and he's not being compensated enough by his law firm, so he takes a little out of the trust fund each time he gets a, or takes, I mean, isn't that?
I make no excuse for him taking funds from his law.
Okay, so we don't.
I do think there are a number of factors in mitigation. Well, the Buster case, I think we all know that case. Buster completely scorned the whole disciplinary process, refused to cooperate, didn't appear. I don't think there's any, that case is totally inapplicable.
Let me ask you another question. The brief, I think, makes a good point that on the surface it appears in most of these cases there are clients that are harmed by the conduct of the lawyer. Of course, we look at those pretty seriously. Here, it appears on the face that $21,000 was taken from there, not given, not recorded, reported to the law firm. But these green slips, he apparently put green slips in clients' files indicating that they had paid less of their fee than they'd actually paid. What would happen if something had happened to the respondent? He was in, had a, you know, an accident. He was out for 6 months.
And they had a different problem. That's why I've been very careful on this matter.
So that is instance,
there wasn't the usual type of situation, for example, with Ostreicher, which I think we gave him a year, where he just took an $18,000 check and cashed it, an $18,000 federal check. He was indicted and convicted, and we gave him a year off. But this didn't hurt any clients.
Well, but my point was, what would happen if the respondent here were ill for a period, or died for a period of time, and the firm that went through these files and found slips that indicated that the clients hadn't paid what they'd actually paid, what the clients would have bear some harm, wouldn't they?
Right. Under that hypothetical, there's potential harm to clients. Exactly right. I'd like to refer the court to Judge Kogan's letter, which, in truth, really did persuade me to be here today. I'd like you all to turn with me to, I actually wrote two letters. I'd like you to turn to me in the first case, hit panel 8. I feel this is a critical letter. As the court will recall, of course, Judge Kogan has been appointed to our hearing and fitness committee. Served honorably as one of the top trial judges in our state. I think he's in the chair with respect to the California Sports Association.
And this is a letter as a character reference for this respondent?
Yes, it does actually. Wrote one.
Which you probably know, I feel that in itself is subject to criticism, that a judge, in violation of the Code of Judicial Conduct, issued letters.
I was ready for that question. If you go to tab, D, you'll read your commissioners. Attorney Mark Diego has requested by way of subpoena, that I write you concerning my observations as a professional comments. He did not violate. I know what you're
talking about. Yeah, I still don't even believe
well,
that we should have that.
Well,
right?
Yeah. Well,
I know that he's written a letter about this fellow, so you can read it, but isn't the issue here that we have, you know, what looks to me to be calculated and fairly long-standing pattern of deceit, and the deceit, the folks deceived here were partners with whom this gentleman was in a fiduciary capacity, just as he would be with clients, right? So, you know, my question is, don't these activities belie the fact that he would have the character and fitness to be in a position of trust?
Well, I think there's no such thing as a theft without deceit. I think they're all thefts, thefts, thefts. I remember a colleague of mine, the California Court, Judge Rita, he would like to point out before I sit down, it's worthy of note, when this matter was brought up by the firm, he immediately made a complete press of the matter of his involvement, got this car, drove down to Columbus, and made a complete confession to Mr. Stern. By the way, Mr. Stern and I agree that a 2-year suspension is always justified in this particular case. That's the only issue before the court, his record and his conduct in his community justifies suspension of some part of the 2-year period.
Let me ask you on that point. As you know, the distinction between the 2-year suspension and the indefinite is that with the 2-year suspension, the respondent, the lawyer, gets his or her license back by the filing of just fairly perfunctory information. With the indefinite suspension, the court has a chance to review the conduct of the lawyer during the period of when they're sitting out. In view of the pattern of deceit here by this person, for whatever reason, shouldn't the court look at him again before we allow him to have his license back?
I really appreciate that question. We've had both common police organizations in this small county stand up and count. They really think that this sort of situation could conceivably occur.
The problem is they're not accountable for him getting back in the practice and doing something again. We are. They're not. It's easy for them to do that, but it is not for us.
The same thing was true in Osterhacker. The same thing was true in Martin. The same thing was true in Payne. The Payne case was mentioned in Judge Tobin's letter, his old partner. We gave him 6 months, and Tobin looked at the facts, knew the facts. He was his partner, knew the facts, and said that, you know, the action was basically the same. Well, I do think that I've almost used up my time, and I'd like to save the balance of it.
And you know how strict we are in time here, don't you, Mr. Wright?
Pardon?
You know how strict we are in
I
time
know,
here.
I watched the last case. I'll try to see if I can get someone to ask me a question and slip it up in 10 minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Solacek. You might pull the microphone a little bit closer to you.
Is that better?
That's better.
For a period of 3 years, the respondent in this case engaged in a deliberate act of misappropriation of monies belonging to his employer. Over the course of time, he improperly obtained approximately $20,000 in borrowed money. The discrepancies were inadvertently discovered when the firm began using a new accounting system. And when confronted with the discrepancy, the respondent did admit to the conduct. The respondent offers several arguments as to why the sanction of an indefinite suspension as recommended by the board should not be imposed. Firstly, he states that the cases previously decided by this court, the Bossinger and Pauley matters, are significantly different than the matter at hand. As support for this assertion, he indicates that the respondent is the son of an Appalachian steelworker, that he worked full-time to put himself through law school, and that he worked for a small law firm in a rural community. As the Chief Justice noted during the respondent's argument, the oath taken by attorneys when admitted to the practice of law does not distinguish between individuals of meager means and those of substantial background. An individual who must work more diligently to obtain the privilege to practice law is not excused from conforming to the rules of conduct.
Let me interrupt you. Is the disciplinary counsel's position? I guess I'm wondering why we have a rare situation here where the board is actually stricter than the relator is in their recommendation. Is it the disciplinary counsel's position that a 2-year suspension is appropriate because of the character references, that we don't have to be concerned that this respondent will do this? Engage in this pattern of taking money again, or what's the rationale for not recommending an indefinite suspension? If you
at the panel hearing to the respondent, the disciplinary counsel considered remorse shown by the respondent, but at the hearing and that came forward to the disciplinary counsel voluntarily, the fact that he was paying restitution and the amount of money involved. did not place high consideration on the character letters when we made our recommendation because we were unaware of what his character references would be.
He looked at his conduct and that he, which speaks well of him, that he initiated the action against him. Realized obviously what he's done something wrong, which sometimes we don't see from lawyers, and that weighed fairly heavily, I would guess.
That's correct. And in doing that, we looked at the Crawley standard that was promulgated by this court. We looked at the differences between the Crawley case and the present case and weighed those differences in making our recommendation of the 2-year suspension.
If I'm correct, though, his coming down to see Mr. Stern really came after the firm confronted him about the discrepancies. In other words, he was first caught, then he confessed. Is that correct?
That is absolutely.
It wasn't the guilty conscience getting to him, and then he decided to come clean on his own.
That is absolutely correct.
Also, in looking at the record, much is made of the medical expenses and that sort of thing. Yet, if I'm correct, it started in 1990. This pattern.
The kind of thing went on for about a period of years. I believe it was right around 1990.
But this wife surgery didn't occur until 91. He makes much of a boating accident where he has all the expenses of a boat. Do you find any absolute correlation between these actual expenses and what he's claiming in mitigation?
We don't find the financial difficulties in the funds of victims to be real heavy as far as a mitigating factor, and the defendants to be a much concern to us. We didn't take that into great consideration in determining to recommend a 2-year suspension rather than an indefinite. The respondent also states that this matter is different from the Crawley due to the amount of money that was misappropriated, and as the board appropriately noted in its findings, it should matter little whether tens of thousands of dollars are misappropriated or whether a great amount of money is misappropriated or whether a small amount is misappropriated. In both of these cases, the respondent deliberately and intentionally took money from their law firms for their own personal gain. And as to the Bussinger case, we can see that the matter is distinguishable and that the respondent in Bussinger did not participate at any level with the disciplinary proceedings and took that into consideration in making our recommendations.
Your point, I think, is that to the extent that this kind of activity, this pattern of taking money that isn't yours, is to the extent that it's a character flaw in somebody who does it to support a high lifestyle, and it's the same character flaw to somebody who does it to support a lower lifestyle.
That's exactly correct. The standard promulgated by this court in the Crawley case noted the calculated and deliberate manner in which the respondent conducted and concealed his fraudulent schemes, his gross abuse of the position of trust and responsibility for personal gain, the amount of the theft, the length of time over which the thefts occurred, and the concern that the respondent's testimony offered in mitigation and justification of the theft demonstrated a fundamental lack of appreciation for the lawyer's ethical obligations to the profession and the public. The board, in considering this standard, determined that an indefinite suspension was warranted due to the calculated and deliberate nature of the respondent's conduct. They further emphasized their concern that they believed an indefinite suspension was proper because he abused a position of trust for a significant period of time for personal gain.
Counsel, this may be totally irrelevant. Was anything made of the fact that he's been held in associate status for, 12 years?
The respondent didn't necessarily raise that as a specific issue.
Isn't that a bit unusual?
I would be able to say, Your Honor, I don't know how a small law firm, or rather a large law firm, handles associate positions.
But there was nothing presented indicating that he felt that his employers had somehow been scrooges with him or had taken advantage of him in terms of the employment.
The record, I think, shows that the respondent believed that the better cases were not given to the associates in the law firm, that the money-making cases were not given to the associates. However, I think the respondent had other options. He did not need to make appropriate money from the firm. He could have sought other employment. He could have gone out on his own practice. I think that those are the options that should have been considered.
In fact, he makes sort of a battered woman syndrome type of argument, does he not?
And I think he does, yes, Your Honor. Secondly, the respondent stated that the penalty as recommended by the board is unduly severe. findings of fact stated without reservation that there are certain acts which, when an attorney commits them, deserves to be our punishment, and death is perhaps a quintessential act in this regard. The record shows that the respondent, over a period of time, engaged in a deliberate act of misappropriation. He knowingly placed fraudulent and misleading green slips in client files, indicating a receipt of a certain amount of fees, when in fact the fee received and that paid by the client was greater than that accounted for. On occasion, he forwarded correspondence to his clients in an attempt to cover up these acts. By his own admission, his conduct was improper and imprudent. Courts in other jurisdictions have found that the misappropriation of foreign money by Delaware deserves severe sanction. In In Re Matter of Siegel, a New Jersey case in 1993 with very similar facts to this case, the court determined that the respondent's extensive $25,000 and extended 3-year misappropriation of foreign money from Hillis Farmers. In the Siegel matter, like the incident case, the respondent voluntarily admitted to the conduct when confronted by the firm, paid full restitution, and offered evidence of good character and an impeccable reputation of mitigation. The court noted, however, that the respondent's acts revealed a pattern of activities to the broadest partners, and that in cases involving misappropriation, the importance of good character and good reputation is diminished as mitigating testimony. At what point do we as a profession begin to say that enough is enough? The misappropriation of funds by an attorney is conduct infected with deceit and dishonesty. If a lawyer converts money to his own use without the firm's authorization, he is subject to disciplinary charges and should be suspended. The respondent's conduct in this case reflects the deceitful and dishonest nature that violates the general precept that an attorney should avoid deceit and dishonesty. However, it cannot be measured merely in terms of monetary damage, as it is the harm perpetrated upon the legal profession and its reputation, as well as the image instilled in the minds of the public concerning the reliability and trustworthiness of those in the legal profession that is the most concerning.
What's your position today in terms of the indefinite suspension? Do you think that's too severe, or?
If this court determines that an indefinite suspension is appropriate, we certainly support that position. We're recommending at a minimum a 2-year suspension. As the court certainly notes, that the only distinction between the two is whether you believe the respondent should prove his fitness to practice law by clear and convincing evidence at the end of the 2 years. The other instance that you may want to consider is whether or not a term suspension of 2 years will be a great enough deterrent to both the respondent as well as to other attorneys in the profession for this kind of conduct, to show whether the risk of engaging in this kind of conduct.
We do, unfortunately, see, this is not the only case we've seen where somebody took money. And unfortunately, often it's from clients, which I assume you would agree. Yeah, I mean, isn't that even worse than taking it from your law firm, or is there no difference there?
Stealing from a client is certainly a conduct.
All right. And unfortunately, in a number of those, they're less than cooperative with disciplinary counsel, less than remorseful. A lot of things that we don't see here. And the typical sanction is indefinite suspension. So I guess I'm wondering, what's the reward for being cooperative, coming clean, making restitution, all of those things, if the penalty is going to be the same?
What would be those factors that have compelled us to recommend a 2-year suspension?
Okay. So I guess what I'm trying to elicit is, where are you really on the penalty?
At a minimum of 2 years suspension, Your Honor.
Do you think the court should not consider this farmer?
I think that that's certainly up to the court's discretion. I believe that when you consider the mitigating evidence, the fact that he came forward and has been out of cooperative.
But he did come forward after they had the goods on him, so
that's
to put
true.
It in a colloquial.
And did you only give that,
I mean, it was pretty clear what he'd done. He didn't, as Justice Stratton pointed out, he didn't do it because he had pangs of conscience. He did it because his the partners went to him and said, look, we know, look what you've done, and what could he do? I mean, he can deny it, or he can be cooperative, which fortunately he was. But we've had cases where, unfortunately not very many, but where the lawyer does come forward on their own volition. So that, I guess, well, I'm not going to argue with you, but that's not quite as strong a point as it would be if he'd done this on his own.
And I certainly don't think that evidence should be looked at blindly. I think that it should be given the weight that's due it, as opposed to the greatest weight. Any lesser sanction than a 2-year suspension will not properly impart to the profession, the respondent, or the public the seriousness of his conduct. It is up to this court to determine whether an indefinite suspension is appropriate, and instead, we respectfully suggest that this court adopt the findings of fact as recommended by the Board of Commissioners and do no less than impose a 2-year suspension against the respondent. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hollinger. Sherratt, you saved 3 minutes of your time.
Good. I'd like to answer a question. Why did disciplinary counsel, I think they're firmly in place in 2 years, at least that's my understanding. Why did they recommend 2 years rather than indefinite suspension? Well, I'll tell you why. Now, they apparently have read the Reisman case, which we decided. They certainly read Ostreicher, which came out of Southern County. They read Lawrence. All of those cases involved felonies. All of those cases involved conversion of the client's funds. However, there were a lot of mitigating circumstances surrounding the scene. They've also read, of course, the Payne case, which is alluded to in Judge Tobin's letter. Payne had misapplied the state funds, written himself checks from a trust account without court approval. They've written numerous NF checks, and yet Payne received only a 1-year suspension with 6 months stay. I guess my answer to the question that was put, why are they recommending only 2 years rather than indefinite suspension? I think they're recommending that the court be consistent with its prior decisions. I would strongly hope that they would. In the balance of my time, I'd like to talk about the three additional authorities cited by the later, which I'm going to leave copies of these cases with the marshal. One of them involved a fellow by the name of Ezra, over in New Jersey. Strong language with respect to theft. He took $200,000 from his partners and went forward with the claim that he was a company agent. I can imagine, and that was the court rejected that claim, said he knew what he was doing, and suspended him. I can imagine what this court would have done with that particular individual. The second case involved, that was in Maryland. The second case involved a New Jersey disbarment, where a fellow named Wilson stole the client's money, forged the client's signature in order to do so, failed to return the funds from the forged checks, refused to cooperate with disciplinary proceedings, and did not even appear in the case. Far from there being any extenuating circumstances, the New Jersey Review Board found that Wilson lied to his clients and advised them to commit fraud. I would recommend that they look at this. As far as the West Virginia case, that stands for proposition.
Does Mr. Wright, does, you know our rules. Does Mr. Stern have a copy? Did you? These weren't filed.
These are cases. Oh, no, no.
They're filed? He had, okay.
No,
right.
No,
okay.
No,
I thought you said you were going to supplement the record somehow.
No,
with
no, no. I know that the court doesn't have copies of those. I don't know
okay.
Whether or not I went up to the library and read them.
Well, good for you.
I know. The Douglas is here to bring you up. But anyway, no, those cases have been filed by Mr. Stern's office. And I got a copy of the citations. And I read them. No, they're nothing new. These are just cases that they filed. Well, I'd like to conclude because I don't want to take up much more of the court's time.
And because your red light's on.
Is it on?
Yes.
I would have taken this case if I didn't really believe that this court should follow some of his prior cases. I think that this young man deserves some measure of mercy. And I would hope that the court would see fit to suspend a year or 2 year suspension of the disciplinary counsel is recommended. And one last question as far as associates are concerned. I don't know, some of the firm.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.